Good morning. My name is Michael Oldfather, and I am today's convener. The job description for that role includes responsibilities that range from planner and coordinator, facilitator, all the way to sergeant at arms. With respect to the latter, it is my duty to start and end on time, and along the way, to remind anyone who speaks to use a microphone so that people wearing headsets can hear you and so that your words will be recorded for posterity and for those who listen to us online, well, tomorrow maybe, or later tonight. This morning's program is one of several we present each year that focus on the arts. Today, it's music's turn. Just as we welcome everyone here without regard to gender, age, wealth, education, political affiliation, sexual orientation, occupation, ethnicity, or almost anything else, there are no tests for musical aptitude. Whether you have played a musical instrument continuously since childhood, quit after five lessons, or taken up the harmonica in retirement, we are glad that you've chosen to be with us today. Whether your tastes run to rap music, bluegrass, jazz, Sousa, Schubert, Bartok, who was a Unitarian, Sinatra, Janis Joplin, or her uncle Scott Joplin. Whatever your preferences, we're glad you're here. It is our fervent hope that beginners of all ages, experienced amateurs, and professional musicians will find some way to participate comfortably in the fellowship's musical life. We hope also that listeners will find performances and group singing and rewarding and sometimes even inspiring. There are announcements of coming events in your order of service in the Sunday bulletin. They are available online at uufm.net and the monthly newsletter, copies of which are available in the narthex. And I have two to read. First, October 1 through 7 is Hug an Atheist Week. In some communities, there are activities that involve fundraising for Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, but I don't think that's here. After the hug, or hugs, you have to work out donation arrangements on your own. There's an insert describing a new event that's going on beginning Tuesday night, a potluck, and then related activities. And I have this addition to add. Everyone is welcome. You could get a chance to see what people are doing, UUFN at work, towards our vision. come help or just to have fun. Move now to opening words and the chalice lighting. This comes from Bruce Marshall's essay, Like Singing in the Bathtub. Marshall's starting point is poet Allen Ginsberg's assertion that spirituality, that slippery concept, should be like singing in the bathtub. You don't have to plan for it, study for it, or fit it on your calendar. You just do it in the midst of whatever you have to do anyway. Singing in the bathtub or the shower is unself-conscious. You don't worry about how it sounds or how you look doing it or whether you've kept your skills current since the last time you sang in the bathtub. You just sing. But the same could be said for standing in the rain, lying in the grass, walking in the snow, being present to your own breathing, and the heartbeats of the person next to you. As we light the chalice this morning, as we begin every service, may we remember to approach life with spontaneity, with a lack of self-consciousness and simplicity. That's how best to experience our relationship to the force that gives us life. It is like singing in the bathtub. Well, we move to our opening hymn, but we don't all move there. What I would like is for singers to come to the front here, and we'll give you an idea of what's going to happen. 7 from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and we are going to sing it in German first, the two verses that come second, but we're going to do it first, and then I'll ask you to rise as you are able and to join us in singing the same two verses only in English. They come first, the German comes second. I don't know why it's done that way, but it is. We should label such things time for reflection or something like that. Oh, thank you. We now turn to a portion of our service where people have an opportunity to speak about some major event in their lives or some issue that is of concern in their lives. Joys, passages, whatever. And there will be a microphone coming to you to do just that. And so there must be somebody who has a joy or a sorrow or something. There's one, William.
My name is Victoria, and I'd like to share a concern I have for my daughter, Jessica. Her family is going through a bitter divorce, and I am concerned for her welfare. Thank you.
I'm Lori Cross, and I just want to announce that a friend of mine, who I have not seen for 50 years, will be in town tonight, and we're going to spend some time together. It's kind of like Rip Van Winkle.
Ken Embers, I'm going to introduce my guest. Is it?
Sure.
Did we do? Today, Bob Kelly is going to be with us. He's a former high school teacher, and he's going to work with our religious education class. So we're glad to have him here, and I know a lot of you know him, and he's a childhood friend of mine.
Oh, welcome.
We're studying different religions in religious education, as we're wont to do. And as I was looking through this book on Buddhism, it's a Buddhist approach to ending release from addictive patterns. And they had a comment on spirituality that you alluded to earlier, and I would like to read this. It says, from a Lama, says this, "I hope that you understand what the word spiritual really means. It means to search for, to investigate the true nature of the mind. There's nothing spiritual outside. My rosary isn't spiritual. My robes aren't spiritual. Spiritual means the mind, and spiritual people are those who seek its nature."
Larry Weaver, my wife and I had a lovely day yesterday, and it concluded in a marvelous performance at Manhattan Arts Center of Pirates of Penzance that has Dick Beeman as one of the leading roles. It's terrific. It's a wonderful production. I recommend everyone see it. It's on this afternoon and then all next weekend. So.
Well, the microphone is moving over there. Go ahead. I want to say that I spent last weekend at the 55th reunion of the Beatrice High School graduating class. We did not have to have valet parking for the walkers rascals.
I'm Sylvia Beeman, and I hope you all come next Saturday from 9 to noon for a spiritual experience on work day, taking care of our beautiful grounds. If you can't come that day, just call me. I'll meet you out here some other day if you want to come. It actually really is a spiritual experience. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Charlie Kempthorne. I've been on a long trip with my wife out west, and the notable thing I want to mention today is I had a reunion with my long-lost brother. We haven't met or talked to each other in 16 years, and he's supposedly dying of cancer, but he looked awfully good, and we talked for 12 solid hours. And actually, his cancer is in remission for now, but he's 79, and it was really wonderful to meet with him again after all these years. Thanks.
Hi, Joy. Stephen's back for time being for the church services, so that's a joy to me.
Yeah.
I have both a joy and a concern. First, the concern. I have several friends that are struggling in their lives, and they're suffering from sadness and depression. So if we could send prayers out to all the people that in this area that are struggling with depression, it's a very hard thing to go through. Sometimes feels very lonely. And the joy I have is I was able to bond with a family, and we went camping in my backyard. We went fishing, and today after church we're going to the Discovery Center, which I want to let you guys know the Discovery Center is free today. So if that's an activity you want to do with your friends.
I'm going to the Discovery Center with Dick and Judy, and after Daddy's Discovery Center, we're going to go back home.
Pat Embers, yesterday I had the great pleasure and honor of going to the Kaw River Point between in Kansas City, where the Missouri and the Kansas meet. It was fantastic, and it's a great park now. If you ever go down there, it's really great. And I heard Robert Kennedy Jr. and Bill McKibbins give their speeches in the Concert of the Climate, for the Climate. And there were about six bands there. It was raining. We didn't care. We sat through it. They covered everything that they needed to, and then when the sun came out, they uncovered. Anyway, it was very inspiring, and I'm glad I went, and I really promote the climate change work that's being done.
And Al Forster, I have a concern. It involves those who are involved with this craziness that's going on in Congress of their refusal to do their job. I think they ought to resign. My son and daughter-in-law are both affected by this action that they're taking. But I also think of all the many other families that are affected. And I hope you'll keep your thoughts in mind about all those who are affected by this craziness that's going on.
My name is Tom Phillips, and I have a big joy today because it was 1 year ago, or a little, maybe 4 hours slight of that, that Stacy and I were married in this room.
All right. Thanks, William, and for those thoughts that were in your heart, we share them as well as we can. Now it's time for the children to come forward, and the children are going to be around the piano. So we've got this front row here cleared off and some on the floor. And Slavomir is going to tell you what he has up his sleeve. Over by the piano.
Okay. Oh, you can sit here, sure. I just have a couple questions for you, and then I'm going to play something, and we're going to talk about it a little bit. So, question number one. If you wanted to compose a piece of music, what would you do? Yes?
You write the music?
Write the music, write what? Write
the notes.
The notes, yes. On a piece of paper.
And play it to
an audience. Right, that's a, yes. So I'm just repeating what he says so that everybody can hear. Yes, you write notes on a piece of paper. You write a tune. That's a very good answer. Okay, there's a tune here. Do you know this tune? Yes, what is it? Twinkle, twinkle, little star. Okay, and actually that tune does not have a composer. It's sort of anonymous. Someone unknown wrote it and people just liked it and they kept repeating it so that everybody knows it. But there is a problem with writing melodies. Melodies are rather short. Let's say, happy birthday. Well, that's just about half a minute. Maybe it's 1 minute long. I mean, well, if you can repeat the words and keep repeating it, so maybe it will become 3 minutes. But well, let's see. You have someone says, well, I'm having my birthday next month, and can you please write a piece that is 10 minutes long for my birthday? What do we do? This is a very good question. Well, right. Well, we can write an unending melody, but if the melody keeps going and going, then people will fall asleep. So that's a problem. There's a limit, you know, how much we can write a different melody and put it next to the, our first melody. That's a possibility. Then we can go back to our first and so on. So we can alternate different melodies. Very good. But let's see what Mozart did. Let's play the tune again. Okay. Let's see what he did here. What did he do? No? I can't hear you. What is he saying? Yes?
He put it longer and put different notes.
Well, yes, there's more notes here, and they are in different rhythm, and so it's more lively. Yes, and the melodic notes are delayed. Okay. Let's see what he did next page. What did he do here? Looks like there's more than one melody here. And there's a second one, and a third one, and an ending. Like a canon. He changed the texture. Now, before we just had one melody, now we have three melodies, which are sort of repeating each other with a delay. It's called polyphonic texture. Okay, so he's playing with the melody. Well, what did he do next? First question, is it still happy or is it already unhappy?
Unhappy.
He changed the mood.
It's more like a mystery song.
Right. Now it's slower and it's like tiptoeing in dark or something. Yes. And he changed the beginning. The beginning was... And now we have... So that's my answer. It's called a variation technique. You take a very simple melody. Actually, the simpler the melody, the more you can add to it. So if the melody is very ornamented and long and has many notes, it's actually already decorated. If the melody is very simple, you have lots of potential. You can do lots of things with it. That's the lesson for today. It's called variation technique. Thank you.
Called upon to pull together a program of this sort or anything related to it, there are a stack of books I start with, and one of them is Kent Nerburn's Letters to My Son, Reflections on Becoming a Man. And there are 28 essays in this and on a wide variety of topics, death, love, marriage, work, and so on. But this is from The Miracle of Giving. And it's about 4 pages long, but the final paragraph does the job. It reads, "Once you become a giver, you will never be alone."
Thank you.
I'll have a little introduction for our program. This morning's program began life as a doctoral dissertation. Well, I wrote a dissertation once, too. Here it is, an application of cost-effectiveness analysis to 29 selected in-service programs in economic education. A little over 200 typed, double-spaced pages of text, tables, bibliography, and an appendix. It is modeled as something called an educational production function. Such things are used to measure the effects of different treatments and financial outlays on the scores of students here, and elementary and secondary teachers, on standardized tests controlling for relevant differences in the students and schools. In this case, summer and school year institutes in which the subjects were enrolled. At my defense, a great deal of discussion centered on creativity, not in terms of the conceptualization of the problem or the novelty of the results. Nope, it was on my handling of a problem, as presented in the appendix. In order to feel comfortable about the size of my sample, I had to harmonize the scores of students who had taken one of two different standardized tests. One of the tests had 50 questions and the other had 33. So, you say the obvious solution was to multiply the scores of the teacher who had taken the shorter test by 50 and then divide by 33, but there was a problem. The shorter test was considerably more difficult, and so I had to devise and defend a more complicated conversion. After considerable discussion among committee members and explanation by me, creativity concerns morphed by consensus into okay, and I passed. The most important thing of all. We are about to hear about a very different and much more intriguing kind of research. I don't know what happened at Slavomir's defense, but I do know that the result is an unambiguously creative masterpiece, and we are privileged to be present to sample some of this remarkable scholarship. Slavomir, I don't know where you're going to start, but...
Thank you, Michael, for the wonderful introduction. And as I woke up this morning and realized that I am nervous, I suddenly realized that I became a musician, perhaps because I didn't like talking. Then I thought that maybe actually I have discovered the reason why music was created altogether. There are many. Theories. One of them, you know, people, the Marxist theory. People were working in the field and they realized they're doing something in rhythm. So that's how rhythm was invented. The other theory is people heard a bird and decided to imitate the bird, and so on. My theory was they just wanted to stop talking. the ironic thing is that when people stop talking and start making music, then immediately after making music, they start talking about what they just did. And that is called research in music. And has to do just with human nature. After we do something, we talk about it. So generally, performers are expected to write a dissertation just as a student that is majoring in musicology or music history. But we are usually divided in two groups. We have to declare our preference for music theory or preference for music history. People that do theory, they would analyze compositions pretty much like, you know, we are used to people describing a painting to us, the relationship between light and shadow, the proportions, how is the painting centered, where is it going to the right, is it the center in the center, how is the optical perspective in this piece of painting, if there is any, and so on. So theorists analyze the harmonic language, all the relationships between chords. They analyze the melodic language because it's different. Bach writes different melodies than Beethoven. Then they look at the style. What do composers have in common in 18th century, let's say in 1790s? So titles like Development of Beethoven's Style in His Piano Trios is a very common title. It's several thousands pages have been written about that subject. And similarly, the presence of Hungarian folk elements in Béla Bartók's piano music, the Unitarian Béla Bartók, that's a very common thing for theorists to do. The historians, however, they discuss slightly different things. They discuss how the style developed over the years, how it was changing. So what is different in 1770 versus 1790 in the style which we call the classical era? It's actually different. They discuss the role of music in society. It is only in the 19th century when music actually in Europe becomes an independent art. It's not dependent on church or patronage of rich people. It's actually an independent field. Especially in Western classical music, what we have is instrumental music. Instrumental music, the one without the talking, without the words, is considered the highest form of musical discourse. What else do they do? They are interested in the history of musical interpretation. People played differently 60 years ago. The expectations were different. There were certain things were in vogue, so to speak. Something was fashionable, something that is not fashionable today. People investigate the history of technical aspects of playing the instrument. For example, 300 years ago, no one used this finger on keyboard. They thought it was not usable. Okay? So these things change. These are very interesting. They investigate the history of the instrument. This instrument here is a replica of 1870 instrument. Basically, the piano stopped developing in about 1870, so everybody is making replicas of that particular model by Steinway. Then people investigate, of course, the history of musical notation. They investigate the history of the profession. The professional musician is not something that has always existed. Professional meaning independent musician. So we usually, the honor goes to Mozart because he quit his job in Salzburg because his employer was very mean, the Archbishop of Salzburg. They didn't like each other, and the year 1781 is the breaking point in the history of our profession, that the first-time musician says, no, I'm going to make it on my own. Well, he didn't quite make it on his own, but at least he made a statement. So, in my case, of course, I'm a pianist, so, I'm fascinated with composers that contributed to piano music the most, Chopin, Liszt, Schubert, Beethoven, Mozart. So I was initially interested in people that influenced Chopin because he does not come from Vienna. He does not come from Paris, Rome, London. He comes from a much smaller city without any major musical personality. So, almost from the beginning, his musical language is very mature. So we're really looking for influences. We already have analyzed the contents of his library, and we know every book that he owned. we know that a capital city of roughly 100,000 people, maybe like Topeka, Warsaw in Poland, they have many artists traveling from the East Coast to West Coast, in this case here, from the Western Europe to Russia. So they had lots of visiting artists, and so he could hear them. That's one possible influence, one certain influence. I was looking for a composer that directly influenced Chopin, and I discovered a woman composer. Actually, I didn't discover her. She was known for that reason, mostly. And then I decided to write a dissertation about her and her music. And the more I wrote and the more I investigated, the more fascinating the project became, to the point that finally, well, the book, the dissertation became a book, and so then I became a published author. And a few years later, this idea of recording her entire piano music suddenly occurred to me, which involved some more research. So this is the recently released CD of her music. Now we can go to the biography of that person. Her name is Maria Szymanowska, and she was born in 1789 in Warsaw, in Poland. And then immediately we have to say, well, she never went to any music schools. Well, music schools were, first of all, very few, but then they were not open to women. So she had some private instruction in playing the instrument, and suddenly she starts playing everywhere. She is in Paris by the age of 21, then she's in London when she's 25. She plays for the royal family. She plays for the royal family in Prussia, in Berlin. She gets a title. She is the royal pianist of the Russian Tsar. She makes all kinds of connections in Europe. She plays in Italy, in Switzerland, in Netherlands, of course, in Poland a lot. She gets married. She has three children. And in the midst of it, she actually gets a divorce, which is sort of extremely unusual for the time, because the law that introduced divorce was basically very new, like 2 years old. So not to mention there's a certain social stigma coming with the decision to get a divorce. So this is an interesting element of her biography. I couldn't find anything particularly negative, you know, in people's letters or whatever they wrote about her because of her decision to get a divorce. But certainly it was like she was a celebrity, so I guess celebrities, they get all kinds of, you know, credit for being a little unusual. And then at the end of her life, she moves to Russia, and suddenly she dies from an epidemic. There was an epidemic of cholera in Moscow, and the Tsar family, the entire royal family, left town, but I guess she was a little late. So she dies like this. So it's a very sort of a brief appearance on the planet Earth, but she was everywhere. She was really a very famous pianist. She basically was probably the first pianist to make enough money to make a living out of it. Not to mention, she was the first woman pianist to make an independent living from playing concerts and publishing compositions too. So, of course, traveling for a woman at that time was not easy. Anywhere she went, she had to be accompanied by her brother. So basically, or at least her sister. So, you know, there was no such a thing as a woman traveling alone. That's socially unacceptable. So this is certainly, I don't know much of her personal letters or thoughts about that, but certainly she realized that she was an unusual case. Okay, and looks like she really loved playing and composing that much that she didn't mind. So that impresses me because, you know, we make compromises very often. And there you have this first person, the trailblazer, who is opening the gates for other women and for other musicians to follow your bliss, to follow your dream, which it sounds great on a sticker, but actually it's not easy. If you start doing it, it's like, oh my, I just should have rhymed. So that's her life. Now, the music, turns out there is over 100 compositions, 4 hours of music for piano alone, and so that is quite a bit. And so initially the idea, as I said, was to research a composer that influenced Chopin. And yes, indeed you can even write a book about that. But the composer herself became so fascinating that I dropped the initial idea
Yes, I wrote one chapter about that influence and devoted the rest of my project to investigating my composer. So now I will go to the piano and we'll just talk about the music. Well, there is one thing. Oh, can you hear me?
Yes.
The good thing about 19th century is that piano becomes the center stage instrument, not only on stage but also at home. There is a growing middle class, and you know, people don't have radios, they don't have iPods, computers, they don't have TVs. So, as I said, they're tired of talking. They want to break. So she composes lots of pieces for accessible compositions for people to play at home. And many of them are dances. They happen to be, of course, French dances. This is the time of the Napoleonic Wars. So the French army between Haiti and Spain and Russia, the French people are everywhere. The French language becomes the language of diplomacy. And people are dancing French dances. So I'll play for you very short two French dances by Maria Szymanowska. Century ragtime. I always think about this one when I play that piece. But it's all good-natured, and most of this music was written after the fall of Napoleon, and there were several changes in society. People started thinking about democracy. Well, that's also thanks to the existence of the United States of America and thanks to the French Revolution. So the spirit was very democratic at the time. And also, I think Napoleon's wars lasted about 18 years. So that's 18 years of continuous war in Europe and outside of Europe. So when the Congress of Vienna finally happened in 1815, people were extremely happy not to worry about what's going to happen tomorrow, which war is going to be started tomorrow with which country. So this is an expression of relaxation, suddenly, of the tension between countries. Suddenly there's peace in Europe, so people are very happy. The next aspect of her style is, of course, lyricism. And, playing lyrical melodies on the piano, that's a completely new idea, actually. Composers started discussing, expressing beautiful melodies and playing legato-connected notes at the beginning of 19th century, mostly thanks to the popularity of Italian opera. So this piece here, which is one of her longest and biggest compositions, it's called The Nocturne. It's based on a very Italianate melody, but actually, if you look at it, it uses the same, similar, but not the same, but similar variation technique that Mozart was using in his Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. But here you will have a typically romantic melody with big leaps and very expressive, very dreamy, a flowing accompaniment. Again, everything to get that poetic moment, okay? So it's singing in the bathtub, but actually at the piano, because everybody had a piano.
Thank you.
Well, I'll play for you at least one more piece here. First, the interesting part was actually investigating the music, first locating the music. Only some of it was published in the later half of 20th century. So about 80% of it was in a sort of a published form from 1820s in various libraries in Europe. And so I had to request copies of them, and I had lots of trouble reading the score because the way of writing has slightly changed. We are today much more precise. You know, people, first, Beethoven was actually the first composer that began writing exactly what he wants, and if you did not play like he wanted, he would get very, very angry. So that idea of writing precisely what the composer wants, the idea that the piece, that you're supposed to play what the composer wants, is actually very new for that time. Before, you get a sonata by Mozart where you could add some ornaments and improvise one more page of it, and nobody would get offended. Actually, it would be expected that adding ornaments, for example, or changing, making variations on the spot. It was the concept of a finished work was relatively new in music. So, but then, you know, many things are not marked in her music. So, knowing the aesthetics of the time, knowing that, for example, they like connected notes, they like singing notes, I, you know, made an effort to play more what we call legato. The biggest issue were the ornaments, because the ornaments, first ornaments is like a minefield for a keyboard player. And so ornaments in 18th century were played differently in Italy, different in here, like is that my fault, what I'm doing? Oh. So I'll stop moving, maybe. The ornaments were played differently in Italy, in France, in Germany. There were schools how to play ornaments for harpsichord. And then the oldest son of Johann Sebastian Bach, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, published a book about playing keyboard instruments in which he explained the rules. And these rules, we assumed, were followed for another 50 years. By the time my composer is composing and playing in public, the rules change. So I had to make actually a personal decision, which ornament belongs to the older way of playing, or is it the new one or is it the old one? So that's, of course, there will be heated debates about how you're supposed to play a particular ornament, like this one. Is it from the upper note or is it from the main? Well, it sounds differently from main note, but so. Anyway, then, of course, the other problem was the actual practices of publishing and writing. Say a composer would compose a piece of music, and they would, of course, write it by hand, and they would make corrections. So it would be a complete jumble. And they would send the piece of music usually to someone who would copy it neatly. And that copy then would be sent to the publisher. But let's say the composer liked the piece so much, he wrote it twice and gave one copy to his friend for his birthday. And in the meantime, the first copy disappeared, so he wrote it again from his memory. We already have three versions of the same piece. And of course, the people that were copying the music, they were not perfect. They would make mistakes. After all, they did not know the piece of music. I mean, they did not have a CD to compare it to. So they would add their own thing. So by the time we look at it today, we sometimes have four or five versions of the same piece, to the point that the Vienna Urtext Edition, which is a company in Vienna, basically publishes the same piece four times and let the performer decide which version they want to play. There's a source online about Chopin. You can actually see the various versions of the same piece, And so this way, I guess this is the most fair approach to the performer, because the performer finally can see what really happened. Today, our tendency is we want to avoid the middleman who decides you play this ornament this way. We want to give to the performers the raw version, what the composer wrote, and let them worry about the rest. So that requires specific knowledge about the style, about the fashion. So what would they like? Because there is something called a musical truth. Let's say if you play a waltz very, very slowly, no one can dance the waltz. The waltz, in your interpretation, does not meet the requirements of musical truth. So the hymn that we sang was, you know, very nice, good tempo, like a walking, very magnificent tempo character. Character is part of musical truth, but so is the question whether it's soft, whether it's fast, whether the notes are connected, whether it's supposed to be with pedal or no pedal. So we are actually searching for musical truth, which turns out to be difficult if your piece came in an email attachment and looks like a blur. So I think I'm going to play for you what I have personally discovered and what I'm, because I mean, after all, you know, we are comparing sources, comparing biographies. So basically, 80% of the work is comparing other people's work already, which might contain lots of mistakes, and that they sometimes get not to be verified, and very untrue things are being repeated for generations, but that's a different story. About 20% of the research is actually fun. You get to see pieces that no one has ever seen, no one has ever, I mean, maybe they played it, but that would have been almost 200 years ago. So when you find something that, oh, that piece, you know, deserves attention, then you feel like you have made a contribution, and it might be a lasting contribution. Then it's up to performers, which includes me, to keep playing the piece, to attract people's attention. So I discovered a piece called The Romance of Prince Galitzin. Prince Galitzin was a Russian prince. Of course, Poland was under Russian occupation, so there were lots of Russian diplomats and officials at the time. And many of them were actually poets and writers, so she was in that circle of people. And so this is based on a song that the prince wrote. Actually, his great-great-grandson lives in Chicago, Illinois, so I'm sort of in touch with him. But, well, anyway, the prince wrote the tune, Szymanowska wrote the entire composition, and I think this composition is remarkable. So that would be the final work here of music that I play for you. Thank you.
We have time for a couple of questions. I want to tell you that this three CD, 4 hours of Shamanovska is incredible, and Slava, it's selling for $60 on eBay and or Amazon, and more than that on eBay probably. Slavomir has offered, if anyone will buy the set, to donate $10 of it to the congregation. And so afterward, he will be wherever he is. I don't know where that will be. But I will be out there in the lobby with copies of it. And you are welcome to do business with me and with Slavomir and with the fellowship. But there's a little time. I don't know whether there's a microphone or a question that somebody would like to ask, about 2 or 3 minutes here, has it been said? I need to manage
this. Thank you. That was absolutely wonderful and fascinating, and to hear about the development of different aspects of music also. And that reminded me of Liszt a lot. Was she an influence on Liszt? Or did he live before her? Or
well,
the fluidity of it was...
Well, he was born when she was 20. And basically, when Liszt is becoming really famous, she's already in Russia. So I don't think they have ever met. There's a chance that Chopin went to one of her concerts, because there's a mention of that in one of his letters. But as far as Liszt, he's growing up in Austria, close to Hungary. So he's in another part of Europe at that time.
Well, also on the radio, I heard about a new invention on the variation on the piano, standard piano. And instead of having discrete notes, I think it's called a C-board. If you vary the pressure on the notes, it creates sort of like a wah-wah effect. And they... But they played a...
it's called a Beibung. It was in clavichord technique, right? Yes, there was something. They were too equipped a key, and it would sort of make wah-wah. That's true. I did hear that. That is true, yes. Yes.
So, if you had not told me who the composer was, I would have just assumed Chopin. Well, and again, I don't listen to as much of this as you do, so...
Well, first of all, it's never really fully dramatic. I think that has to do with the idea of the wars just ended. People just did not want drama for about 10 years. By the time Chopin and Liszt are mature men, they start writing really, really dramatic music and all over the keyboard, and so... It becomes very pathetic, we can call it. So that's another aspect of the romantic style that has not yet happened, had not even begun.
Well, again, so correct me, Liszt played a heck of a lot of Chopin. He actually was known more as a performer than a composer, right?
Right, that's right. Yes.
Anyway, yes. Did people copy styles, and is there a Chopin-esque style out of Poland of which Chopin, this woman, and maybe two or three others... Because I can, when I hear Russian, I didn't know this woman was in Russia, but she doesn't sound anything like the Rock or, Tchaikovsky. Rachmaninoff's much later, of course.
Right. Well, her style is sort of more Italian opera, actually. She was a very cosmopolitan person, so yes. Yes, she wrote a couple mazurkas in Polonaise, so there's a Polish aspect to her music that, yes.
But...
Well, it is sometimes. It is play. You go to YouTube, you can see plenty of people playing mazurkas by Szymanowska. So.
Well, one more question.
I noticed that some of the pieces sound similar. And how do you compose a piece without sounding similar to something else? Or is everything kind of like I listen to a lot of Bach and stuff, and there's one piece called Anastasia by Slash, and the tune sounds very classical.
Uh-huh.
But how do you, is there a variation on theme, or is it
Well, you know, so we have various forms and genres of music. Let's say a nocturne, we assume it will be a melody and accompaniment. So these kind of, this is called genres, because we don't know what's going to happen in the middle of it. Maybe it will be a variation. Maybe there will be a middle section that will have a different, completely different mood. So that's why we call it a genre of music, not a form. When we have a symphony or a sonata, we know exactly what is going to happen. And I think that has to do with the way people listen to music. We have to start thinking that people listen to music differently in 18th century than in 19th century. What mostly we expect from music today in our everyday life is more sort of a romantic approach. You turn on a song and, oh, that song makes me feel this way or that way. And this is exactly this kind of romantic approach. The 18th century listener, oh, I have an idea, and what is going to happen next? No, so he's interested, okay, what's going to happen with it, rather than how does it make me feel? The entire idea of how do I feel in reaction to music, it's a 19th century idea. So we have to know that when we have a Mozart symphony, they would actually follow the ideas, what happens to them, and they would enjoy that interplay between various tunes or what the composer did with the... That does not make you especially feel like anything. Well, it's just playful. Right, exactly. But then when the changes happen, it makes you feel sort of, oh, this is fun. But not like, oh, it makes me feel so dreamy. You know, so it's a completely different aesthetics.
Thank all of you, too, for being here. Our closing hymn is number 309. It is from the fourth movement of Brahms' First Symphony, so it may be familiar to you for that. All right, let's go. Stand as you're able. Closing words are from Robert Jordan. Music captures our imagination, progressing from sound to tone, to melody, to harmony, to rhythm, to composition, to performance, to listening, to understanding, to ecstasy. But even if you haven't touched all the bases, listening thoughtfully to a performance by someone who has can indeed transport you to ecstasy. Go in peace.